for any sounds or requests that might issue from the room. She had been doing this for weeks. She considered it her job. Lizzie Mitchell pulled into the driveway at Pecan Grove, driving a black 1949 Ford with a cracked window on the front passenger side. When Sitta heard the front doorbell ring, she jumped up from her position outside Vivi's door and ran to see who it was. Vivi didn't want to see anyone, and Sitta was standing sentry. Only the Yayas were allowed into Vivi's room, and sometimes Vivi didn't even feel up to seeing them. Lizzie Mitchell stood in front of Sitta, wearing a blue shirtwaist dress with a gray sweater draped over her shoulders. Painfully thin, with sad blue eyes, she had a frail kind of beauty. Her face, her whole body, appeared tired. In her early 20s, she had beautiful skin, but her teeth were bad, and even Sitta could see she wore the wrong shade of lipstick. She carried a suitcase, and for a moment Sitta thought the woman was a traveler who had stopped to ask for directions. At the sight of Sitta, she gave a quick, forced smile and said, "Good afternoon. Is the lady of the house at home?" Sitta just stared at the woman. Finally, she said, "Yes, my mother is home, but she's busy." "Would you tell her that a representative of the most advanced line of beauty products available in the world today is calling, please?" "Just a minute, please," Sitta said, and left the woman standing at the door. She knocked softly on Vivi's door. "Mama," she asked in a soft voice, "you asleep?" When she got no response, she opened the bedroom door and walked in. Vivi was curled in the bed. The Snickers bar and club sandwich and Coke that Sitta had made for her when she got home from school were still untouched on the TV table.
"There's a lady at the door asking for you, Mama," Sitta said.
"I don't want to see anybody," Vivi said without moving. "Who is she, anyway?"
"She is a representative of the most advanced line of beauty products available in the world today," Sitta said.
"What?" Vivi asked.
"That's what she said, and she has a suitcase."
Vivi slowly propped herself up in the bed, bunching her old feather pillow behind her head.
"She probably just wants to sell me something. Can't you get rid of her?"
Sitta looked at her mother. Her face was pale, had been since she'd gotten home. For the most part, she stayed in her nightgown. She hadn't even worn any of her fabulous hats because she had hardly left the house.
"No, ma'am," Sitta said. "I can't get rid of her."
"Why not?"
Sitta thought for a moment. She glanced down at the cover of her book.
"Because," Sitta said, "she's got on the wrong color lipstick."
"She's selling beauty products and she's wearing the wrong shade of lipstick?"
"I think you need to talk to her, Mama."
"Oh, all right," Vivi said. "Ask her to come in for a minute."
When Vivi walked into the kitchen, Lizzie Mitchell was sitting at the kitchen counter with Sitta. The minute Vivi walked into the room, Lizzie jumped up from the stool.
"Good afternoon," Lizzie said. "Are you the lady of the house?"
Vivi had pulled her green-striped silk bathrobe over her nightgown and stood barefoot. She put her hand on the counter as if to steady herself.
"May I help you?" Vivi asked.
"Yes, ma'am," Lizzie said in a soft voice.
Her eyes went blank for a second, and then she reached into the pocket of her dress and pulled out some scraps of paper that had notes scribbled on them. Attempting to hide the fact that she was reading the notes, Lizzie began her spiel.
"I am here," she said in a terrified voice, "to offer you the golden opportunity to discover the finest line of cosmetics ever made for a woman's skin. The Beautier line is a elite line of beauty products designed for the discriminating lady whose first concern is her looks." run a late line, Vivi said. Yes, ma'am, Lizzie repeated, her hands quivering. It is a elite line.
The correct grammar would be an elite line, Vivi explained automatically.
Pardon me? Lizzie asked, her voice quivering.
Lizzie's scraps of paper fluttered out of her hand onto the floor. Embarrassed, she bent to pick them up.
Sitta watched as the woman seemed almost unable to stand back up when Lizzie did finally right herself. She was in tears.
Sitta wanted to hit her. The last thing she needed was for this woman to upset her mother. Just the week before, Vivi had sort of capsized at the A&P, and Sitta had had to call Caro to come and get them. Vivi moved like someone who was still getting over the flu, tired and uncertain, guarding her energy instead of flinging it around like she used to. Both her father and her grandmother had told Sitta that it was up to her, the oldest, to make sure that nothing upset her mother. To her surprise, Sitta saw her mother touch the woman's elbow gently.
Please, Vivi said, excuse my rudeness. I'm Vivi Abbott Walker, and this is my oldest daughter, Sitta Lee. Won't you sit down, please?
Unable to meet Vivi's eyes, the woman sat back down at the counter.
Would you care for a cup of coffee? I personally do not touch coffee after 10 in the morning. I think I'll have a light cocktail. Shall I make you one as well? Something light.
Lizzie continued to cry and said, coffee, please, if it's not too much trouble.
No trouble at all, Vivi said.
She took ice cubes out of the freezer.
Sitta, darling, do you feel like making some coffee?
Yes, ma'am,
Sitta said, relieved to be given a task. Vivi filled the crystal ice bucket with ice cubes, then dropped a couple into a glass. Into the glass she poured orange juice and a half jigger of vodka. Sitta put water on to boil and measured community coffee dark roast with chicory into the filter of the Chemex coffee pot. She tried not to look at her mother's bare feet. The toenail polish was chipped, something that Vivi would never have allowed when she was well.
I'm sorry, Vivi said. I didn't catch your name.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry, Lizzie said, covering her face with her hands. The first thing you're supposed to do, she mumbled, is introduce yourself to your customer.
Well, give it a try, Vivi said as she stirred her drink.
Sitta could see that her hands were still shaky. Vivi reached into the pocket of her bathrobe and swallowed a huge B12 vitamin. Taking her hands down from her face, the woman said softly,
allow me to introduce myself. My name is Lizzie Mitchell, and I'm your beautier lady.
Pleased to meet you, Lizzie Mitchell, Vivi said, and sat down at the counter with the woman.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mrs. Walker, Lizzie said. You too, Sitta Lee.
Would you like cream and sugar? Sitta asked.
Yes, please, Lizzie said. If it's not too much trouble.
Sitta started to get out the blue coffee mugs, but Vivi said,
darling, let's use china, shall we?
Sitta poured coffee into a china cup and set it out on the counter with sugar, cream, and a spoon. Then she warmed milk on the stove in a little saucepan and made herself a mug of coffee milk. She pulled a stool up to one of the upper cabinets and pulled down the bag of Oreos she'd been hiding from the other kids. She laid cookies out on a plate and joined the women at the kitchen counter.
Tell me, Ms. Mitchell, Vivi said, how did you come to be a cosmetic sales lady?
Lizzie Mitchell, who was raising the coffee cup to her mouth, set it back in its saucer. She tried to speak, but when she did, she began to cry again.
I'm sorry, she said, breathing in short, ragged little breaths. I just started up with the beautier business. Sam, that's my husband. Sam died 4 months ago last week in an accident at the Chulos Lumber Company. I got me two little boys and no insurance.
Lizzie Mitchell stared at her coffee cup and blinked. She seemed shocked that she had just blurted this out to Vivi. As if to try once again to establish herself as a real sales lady, she glanced desperately down at her notes and lapsed back into her rehearsed spiel.
The Beautier line is something I feel honored to be able to represent. If I did not believe in the products 100%, I would not sell them. Now if...
Oh, my God, Mama interrupted. What have you been through? How old are your boys?
Sam Jr. is 4 and my Jed is 2, going on 3.
Sita looked at her mother's fingers as they held her drink glass. She was embarrassed at how unkempt her mother's nails looked. Vivi's hands, her nails, everything about Vivi used to be so cared for, so beautiful. Sita could not understand what had happened to her mother.
Mama, Sita asked, you want a cookie?
No, darling, thank you, Vivi said. Then training her eyes on Lizzie, Vivi asked, where are your boys now? Who is taking care of them?
They're at my sister-in-law's, Bobby's. Her girlfriend, Lurlene, got me hooked up with the Beautier line. Lurlene has got a savings account of her own, and she done so good with her sales they awarded her the Pink Chrysler.
She did so good, Sita said. Vivi shook her head at Sita.
Yes, ma'am, Lizzie said. Lurlene done real good.
I see, Vivi said.
They make Pink Chryslers? Sita asked.
The Beautier man gets cars and has them painted pink for the top sellers. Beautier is your most scientific line of beauty products.
Lizzie took a sip of her coffee.
Scientific, Vivi repeated, and took a sip of her drink.
Oh, yes, ma'am, Lizzie said. It is important to be scientific in today's world.
Then, as if the coffee had picked her up, Lizzie Mitchell seemed to draw herself together. Sita could see the woman's notes tucked in the left sleeve of her sweater. Trying her best to appear natural, Lizzie started her sales pitch again.
The Beautier line costs far less than your Avon products, and yet the quality of these beauty aids has pleased thousands of women throughout Mississippi, Arkansas, and now, Louisiana,
Lizzie Mitchell continued, like a trembling wind-up doll. Vivi lit a cigarette. Sita climbed down from her stool and crossed to the bar to bring her an ashtray. Sitting back down, Sita alternated between watching Lizzie Mitchell and watching her mother. This was the most interest her mother had shown in anyone in a long time.
Ma'am? Lizzie said, if I can just take a minute out of your busy day to show you some of the most modern and scientific beauty boosts available, I can promise you, you won't regret it.
Lizzie Mitchell waited a beat, then reached down for her sales kit. The kit itself looked like a regular train case, but there was a silhouette of two women's heads facing each other, emblazoned on the front in a Pepto-Bismol pink. Moving her coffee cup aside, she set the kit on the counter, flicked its openers, and lifted the lid. Then, as if she saw something terrible inside the suitcase, something no one else could see, Lizzie dropped her head and began to sob deeply. Her bony shoulders bobbed up and down, and her crying sounded almost like that of a small dog. Slowly, Vivi put her cigarette in the ashtray. Leaning in slowly to the woman, she gently lifted Lizzie Mitchell's chin with her hand.
"Darling girl," she said, "are you all right?"
Lizzie Mitchell looked up at Vivi.
"It's my oldest," she said, barely audible. "Sam Jr., he's the one taking it the worst. He wants to be up close to me all the time. Can't stand me to leave."
Sita watched as her mother closed her eyes and listened.
When I left him at Bobby's this afternoon, he started up crying and hollering, wrapped himself around my legs, and wouldn't let go. I walked all the way to the door with him hanging off me. Me and Bobby had to peel him off for me to leave on my sales rounds?
Without thinking, Lizzie Mitchell grabbed onto her butier notes and wadded them up in a ball so that she could no longer see them.
He's thinking you're gonna leave and never come back, like his daddy did, Vivi said softly.
Lizzie Mitchell nodded her head up and down.
That's it. My boy Sam, he is just wired up delicate, she said.
Then Lizzie took a great gulp of air, which caused her whole body to shudder.
I know how that can be, Vivi whispered.
By this time, she was crying too. Sitta was crying as well, but not just over Sam Jr. Using her fist to wipe back tears, Vivi said,
Sitta, precious one, would you please go find us some Kleenex?
When Sitta got back to the table, Vivi was pressing the palms of her hands against her cheeks, and it looked to Sitta like she was trying to hold her face together. Sitta held the box of Kleenex out to Lizzie Mitchell. Even though the woman's face was wet with tears, she took only one Kleenex, like she thought that was the polite thing to do.
You can take as many as you want, Sitta said. We have lots.
Thank you,
she said, taking a few more tissues and wiping her eyes. Then Sitta offered the box of Kleenex to Vivi, who grabbed a handful. Vivi wiped her eyes, which were ringed with eye makeup. Although Vivi had let herself go since returning home, the one thing she remained religious about was her mascara and light brown eyebrow pencil. Without it, her own blonde lashes were so light that she claimed they made her look like an albino. Vivi frowned at the tissues, now spotted with mascara she'd cried off. Then she glanced at Lizzie Mitchell's used Kleenex. Holding up her tissues covered in slashes of mascara, Vivi said,
Will you look at this? Will you just simply look at this?
Lizzie Mitchell and Sitta stared at the tissues Vivi was holding up as evidence.
Every single bit of mascara I put on this morning has ended up on this tissue. Cheap, cheap, cheap. All that mascara I paid good money for has ended up on a Kleenex, and here I am left looking like a hairless dog. And this is not the first time this has happened, let me tell you.
She gestured to her eyes, and indeed her lashes and eyebrows had all but disappeared.
It should be illegal to sell eye makeup that rubs off with the merest provocation.
Vivi paused and pulled another lucky strike out of the pack. She tapped it on the table several times. She took her time lighting it, examining the sterling silver lighter that sat on the table as though seeing it for the first time.
I don't imagine you carry a beauty or mascara line, do you? She said.
Lizzie examined her wadded-up Kleenex. It was moist with her tears, but held no signs of rubbed-off eye makeup. Sitta watched as she reached into her purse and pulled out a cheap plastic compact. Holding it up, she examined her reflection in the small mirror. When she looked up, Sitta saw something in Lizzie's eyes that made her think of a gate opening. Sitta's head tilted slightly to the side, her lips parted slightly, and she thought,
My mother is a kind person.
Lizzie Mitchell closed her compact, took a deep breath, and opened her sales kit again. She pulled her stool over closer to Vivi's and spoke in the voice of a woman who was coming back to life.
Yes, ma'am, Lizzie Mitchell said. Beauteer has a fine, an elite, line of mascara. We call it our wand of beauty. I would be pleased to show it to you. I think you'll find it a bargain at any price if you purchase it as part of one of Butier's mixed gift packs.
Shortly after that first visit by Lizzie Mitchell, Vivi began to get dressed in the mornings. After a week or so, she was still shaky, but she'd agreed to a small dinner party at Teensy's. When Sitta and the other kids came home from school in the afternoons, they no longer found her still in bed with the door closed. They found her making phone calls to friends and acquaintances, talking up the Butier line, especially the Wand of Beauty, which, when Vivi said it, sounded something like a woman's name, Wanda Beauty. On those fall afternoons, when Sitta was still keeping a close eye on her mother, she would sit at the counter and listen as Vivi talked on the phone.
You must let Lizzie Mitchell come show you her beauty line. It's miraculous, Vivi would say. I can shower in it, swim in it, go to a sad movie. You can cry all you want and never, never does it smudge.
It seemed that no matter how many times Vivi repeated these lines, they made her feel better. It was like she'd found a cure for a disease. At Vivi's invitation, Lizzie began coming out two or three afternoons a week, bringing along her little boys. While the boys crawfished or rode Shetland ponies with Little Shep and Baylor, Vivi coached Lizzie on her presentation skills.
"Lizzie, darling," Sitta would hear her mother say, "if you want to feed those boys, then you have got to stop using the word ain't."
Vivi helped Lizzie come up with a kicky sales pitch that she was comfortable with, so she no longer sounded like she'd memorized it.
"You are terrific," she'd tell Lizzie. "Every one of your customers will be delighted to see you at the door."
The names of Lizzie's other products cracked up Sitta and Lulu. Estraglow was supposedly packed with estrogen. Skin Sublime was packaged in a decorator bottle that was lip-shaped. Butier's Hair Magic smelled a little like Evening in Paris. Each of the Yayas bought Lizzie's mixed gift pack. They wouldn't have dared say no. But Vivi was more successful in finding customers for Lizzie among the country women who were married to the cotton farmers who ginned at the same place as Sitta's father. Sitta and Lulu took to calling the skin cream Lizzie Lotion, but when Vivi heard, she fussed at them.
"Don't y'all dare make fun of that young woman," Vivi told them. "She is trying to make something of herself."
With each visit, Vivi herself seemed to be getting her own strength back. By the middle of November, Caro had even been able to talk her into a game of tennis at the country club. Although Sitta could not have put it into words, it seemed that the Butier line was not only a cosmetics line, but also a lifeline. Not only for Lizzie Mitchell, but also for her mother. One afternoon, Sitta came home to find Lizzie's car in the driveway. She expected to find Vivi and Lizzie at the kitchen counter, as usual, but instead found the house so quiet she thought nobody was home. It took her a moment to realize that they were out in the den. But when Sitta stepped into the room, she took one look and was filled with terror. Her mother was lying back in Shep's Lazy Boy recliner. She was covered with sheets, and Lizzie stood behind her with her hands around Vivi's neck. Vivi lay perfectly still, with cotton pads over her eyes, her hands crossed over her chest. The two women were perfectly quiet, so concentrated, so unaware of Sitta's presence. For one horrible moment, Sitta thought her mother was dead. Sitta held her breath and stepped closer, her stomach clenched, her heart hammering. It was not until she saw her mother's hand move that Sitta began to breathe again. Then she noticed that Lizzie's hands were gently massaging something pink onto her mother's neck. With small, circular movements, Lizzie stroked the pink concoction up Vivi's neck, then carefully around her temples. Sitta had never seen her mother be touched so tenderly. As Lizzie's customer list grew, and as Vivi resumed her life, their visits grew less frequent. A couple of years had passed when Sitta arrived home one afternoon to see an almost new bright pink Chrysler in the drive at Pecan Grove. Lizzie was wearing a little two-piece suit and a Jackie Kennedy hairdo.
"Well, you look at this," Vivi announced to her children. "Lizzie has won the pink Chrysler."
Lizzie then flung her arms wide like a lady on a TV game show.
"I am a Butier top 10 sales lady," she announced, "and I could not have done it never, ever, without your mother." We're off for a spin,
Vivi announced, climbing into the car. Sita watched as Lizzie backed the big Chrysler out of the drive. She stood at the end of the driveway as the two women rolled down the long gravel road that led away from Pecan Grove in the direction of town. As she watched, she could see her mother's and Lizzie's heads silhouetted against the green fields filled with her father's cotton. For a moment, Sita thought they looked like sisters. Sita took a bite of cheese and got up from the sofa. She walked out onto the deck of the cabin and did a few stretches. Rolling her neck in small circles to relax, she remembered once, many years after Lizzie Mitchell, when she had returned home from LSU for holiday break. She had gone up into the attic looking for extra boxes to wrap gifts in. In the corner of the freezing cold attic was a large cardboard box. She opened it to find that it held many boxes in quite good shape. Perfect, she thought, just what I need. But when she reached down to pick up a few of them, she found that they were not empty. She picked up one of the boxes and examined it. It took a moment for her to recognize the gray and pink packaging, the silhouettes of the two ladies' heads facing each other. But once she opened it, everything came back. It was one of the mixed gift packs from the Butier line. There must have been 30 of them stacked in the larger box, unopened. Another cardboard box stood next to it, and Sita peeked into it as well. More mixed gift packs. Dear Lizzie Mitchell, Sita thought, you came into my mother's life on an afternoon as she hid in her bedroom trying to nurse some long-seated sadness that flows beneath her vivaciousness like a secret river. Mama looked at you, grieving the loss of your husband, struggling to keep your boys alive by selling cheap beauty products with glamorous names to women who could never be perfect enough. As the unsightly tears flowed from your eyes, Lizzie, my mother's eyes watered too. Over a wand of beauty, the scientific mascara that still allowed you to cry, my mother taught me something about what it is to be feminine. Mama taught me a lot of other lessons about femininity, too. Some of them carry marks that no cosmetic can erase. My mother lifted Lizzie Mitchell's chin and said, "Darling girl, are you all right?" My mother slapped my cheek, where sometimes it still stings. My mother also laid her butiered soft palm on my girlish face and just cupped it there for love. I climb to the attic and discover my mother. She is a mixed gift pack. Chapter 15. It was Friday afternoon and Sita was speed walking on the lake path when she saw the gang of little girls on the beach at the bottom of the Quinault Lodge lawn. The volume on her Walkman was turned up loud, the metronomic beat of her advanced classical beat walking driving her relentlessly forward. She exercised like this for an hour and a half a day. In New York, she walked in Central Park. In Seattle, along Lake Washington. Only a blizzard could force her indoors to a treadmill. She passed the scene twice before stopping. Positioning her baseball cap so they could not tell she was staring, Sita observed the scene as she pretended to stretch. Five little girls, ranging in age from 5 to 8, were running and playing. Two of them wore shorts with no blouses. One of them wore a swimsuit with a little skirt on it. Another girl with pigtails wore a short little dress that was soaking wet, and the other, the oldest, wore a pair of jeans rolled up at the cuffs and a little bikini top. Some distance away, a woman about Sita's age sat on a blanket, under an umbrella, leaning back against an ice chest, painting with watercolors in a large sketchbook. Every once in a while, she glanced up to check on the girls. "Look!" one of the girls yelled out. "There it is!" With that, the five of them ran headlong into the lake and began dragging out a large piece of driftwood. Working together, they pulled the log onto the beach and balanced it on a large rock.
This took quite some time, and as Sitta watched, they gave each other directions and encouragement. When the piece of wood was finally on the rock, the girls stood back and admired their work.
A seesaw,
the girl with the pigtails called out.
A seesaw by the seashore,
one of the bare-chested girls said. Then bolting in the direction of the blanket, the other bare-chested girl ran to the woman and announced,
"We built a seesaw!"
"That's great," the woman said. "That is terrific." Then the little girl sped back to the others. Without warning, they abandoned their creation, and the five of them all ran screaming into the lake water. Before long, Sitta heard a voice call out,
"Ahoy there!"
She turned to see a group of two women and three men walking down the path that led to the beach from the lodge. Pointing to an older couple who stood on the lawn waving, one of the newly arrived women began to gather the girls. They came down to the woman on the blanket, and immediately the scene shifted. In a moment, the blanket, ice chest, sandals, towels, and sunscreen were pulled together, and the group started in the direction of the stairs. As they were leaving, Sitta heard one of the women say,
"Oatmeal cookies for the wild girls."
She watched as the woman reached into a bag and handed each of the girls a cookie. As the group climbed the stairs, the older couple who were waiting for them hugged each girl in turn, and the whole group disappeared in the direction of one of the cottages. Sitta stood and stared, as if waiting for the entourage to reappear. When they didn't, she went to sit near the seesaw the girls had created. Staring out into the lake, she hugged her arms around her chest. She craved the warm southern waters of her childhood. She was overcome with longing for the loud messiness of summers at Spring Creek, for the kids and the moms and the mismatched pajamas and Noxzema on her nose at night. She wanted to be part of an entourage like the one she had just witnessed. She wanted to be part of a family. How was it that she was 40 years old and she had created no family of her own? Her life suddenly seemed ridiculous. Her career, her apartment, her creation of worlds on stage, it all seemed beside the point. How was it that she had spent the last 20 years bringing fictional characters to life rather than all too real children who screamed and flew across the sand and hugged you when you handed them oatmeal cookies? How was it she was here at the edge of the continent, alone, while these other women had already made families, surrounded by friends who'd done the same? What was wrong with her? She felt ashamed of her insularity. She longed for rambunctiousness, for the communal craziness in which she'd been raised. She felt sick at the thought of her constant questioning, her constant self-examination. Perhaps I should just finish directing May's new play, leave New York, move to Seattle, and start a family. The wildness of that thought so rocked her that Sitta removed her Walkman, stripped out of her shorts and T-shirt, down to her swimsuit. She walked out on the dock that stretched into the lake and dove straight into the freezing northwest water. The first contact numbed her skin. As she burst back to the surface, she felt painfully alive, charged with energy. She could see the deep blue of the sky and the endless green of the trees that rimmed the lake. Lying on her back in the water, she began to kick hard, stretching her arms out wide. No matter how hard she kicked, she could still hear the laughter of those little girls. Letting herself sink beneath the surface, Sitta closed her eyes and swam down in the direction of the bottom. The icy fluid world felt cleansing. Would that these clean waters could wash away all confusion, all doubt, all sins. She stayed down as long as she could, then broke the surface again, gulping air. Then she began to swim the crawl, rolling her head from side to side to breathe, barely lifting her face out of the water, hands tilted at just the right angle to break the water. She swam like her mother had taught her. "I have already come to terms with all this," she thought. "I never wanted kids, not as a girl, not as a young woman in my 20s, not now, not really.
It's fine with Connor. He made that clear early on. Why do I resent the little families I just witnessed? Why do I fantasize kidnapping those wild little girls? At least for a weekend. Friday afternoons always got to Sitta. If anything made her want a family, it was Friday afternoons. She was always shocked by this longing, but it blindsided her time and again. Friday afternoons. That school is out a whole sweet weekend in front of you feeling. Even in Manhattan, when she saw moms walking their kids home on the Upper West Side from the Montessori school, it hit her. She still longed for those countless Friday afternoons at Pecan Grove. Pecan Grove was a sort of destination house for kids. 900 acres, and all the room in the world to scream and run and ride Shetland ponies and catch crayfish in the bayou and play with the puppies in the huge barn and climb on the old live oak tree. A backyard filled with rope swings hung in the trees where you could swing out over the bayou. An old golf cart her daddy had given the kids to drive all over the plantation when they weren't in the mood to ride horses. A big house filled with toys and musical instruments and tons of food from Vivi's end-of-the-week trip to the A&P. And Vivi herself, who on happy weekends waited for them with open arms in the backyard, excited at the prospect of kids and making fudge and Saturday night at the movies and card games where she and maybe one or two of the yayas would gamble with the boys, happy to take their nickels. It was nothing for 5 or 6 little friends to end up at Pecan Grove for the weekend. It was open house, and Sitta's little girlfriends loved it. Plenty of fried shrimp for Friday night supper, as many cold cokes as you could grab, and if it was winter time, hours in front of the fire in the den, playing the Ouija board with Vivi as she sipped her bourbon. Kids would show up at Pecan Grove without even an overnight bag because they knew Vivi Darlin could supply what they needed. I've got 84,000 extra PJs and 64,000 guest toothbrushes. Just don't bring any head lice, Vivi would say. How could Sitta Walker not think about family on Friday afternoons? As she swam, Sitta calculated ages and stages if she started a family that very day. When my kids start having spend-the-night company, I'll be 47. Okay. When they start dating, I'll be 55. Charming. When they start college, I'll be pushing 60. And when they have their own kids, I'll be out of my mind. She switched to the breaststroke and concentrated on her kick. She told herself, I am only experiencing the last gasps of a completely normal and inescapable biological urge. I have had these spasms before, and they always pass. My life is not one colossal mistake. Angels of the evening sky. Something wants to be born. I'm just not sure what. When she returned to the cabin, Sitta ate standing up, listening to Bonnie Raitt on the CD. She stared at a photo she'd come across when Wade and May were there, the one of Vivi in the backyard, surrounded by the 4 kids. Was this taken on a Friday? No. If it were a Friday, there would have been twice as many kids, spend the night company for all 4 Walker kids. It must have been a school day. Late September, 1962. Her mother is sitting on the pink-checked picnic blanket, there in the big yard that slopes down to the bayou. Sitta is in 4th grade, Little Shep in 3rd, Lulu in 2nd, and Baylor in 1st. If Vivi is on the picnic blanket, Sitta knows she's in a good mood. If Vivi is in her room with the door shut, then you have to leave her alone or else get lucky and find just the right thing to break the spell. You never know exactly what will work. It is magic what makes or breaks Vivi's moods. What on earth did y'all do at Divine Compassion today? Vivi asks, all eager like the kids might have big news. Drop those book sacks and gather round. The 4 Walker kids kneel and flop beside her on the blanket. A lady of malnutrition, Vivi says. Y'all look absolutely famished.
Famished is one of Vivi's words that Sitta loves to roll around in her mouth like candy.
Are y'all really hungry as you look? Vivi says. What did they feed y'all for lunch? It wasn't those big, fat, ugly green peas, was it? Oh, I bet it was awful, whatever it was. I don't know what those nuns do with the money we pay them. Here, little chef, Vivi says, starting to hand out sandwiches. You're my peanut butter man. Sitto, heavy on the strawberry jelly. Lulu, you like lots of everything, so this one's for you. But you can only have one, do you hear me? Hand me those Dixie cups, will you, darling? Bae, sweetie, yours is the one cutting force. Don't worry, I've cut the crust off all of them, you slave drivers, you. Lulu, do not grab. There's enough for everybody.
Vivi pours lemonade out of the cooler. The children hold their sandwiches on little gold cocktail napkins with Happy 10th Anniversary Vivi and Shep printed on them. Vivi freshens her drink from a separate cooler, the thermos that holds her cough medicine. Sitta leans back on the blanket and eats her sandwich. She's been waiting for this moment all day. The taste of the jelly and the soft, fresh white bread make her happy. She watches as Vivi leans back against a stack of pillows. She watches Vivi smoke and stare up at the sky. Smoking and looking up at the sky are some of her mother's favorite things, along with matinees, good hamburgers, Spring Creek, lying in the bed reading a good book, and getting dressed up and having fun. Sitta loves her mother's hands. She loves her fingernails, pretty, rounded nails that Vivi buffs while she talks on the telephone. After Sitta finishes her sandwich, she turns over on her stomach. Vivi reaches over and tickles Sitta's back under her uniform blouse. Vivi has the perfect fingernails for tickling Sitta's back. Nobody can tickle her back like her mother. You have to have nails just like Vivi's to make Sitta feel this good. Sitta put the photo down and closed the album. She walked into the bedroom and took off her clothes. Lying down on the bed, she looked at her stomach. Even after her sandwich, her belly was still flat. She could see where her pelvic bones stuck up on either side. God knows she worked to keep her belly that flat. Reaching down, she ran her hand slowly from one side of her stomach to the other. For the first time in her adult life, the sight of her concave belly did not please her. Instead, it made her feel alone, unused, as though she were the kind of woman who enjoyed packing for a trip more than the trip itself. She thought of the backyard photo again. It had been taken around the time that her mother had sent Baylor to school with one of her garter belts for first grade show and tell. As a result, the school had called and demanded that Vivi come in to meet with Baylor's teacher. Evidently, Vivi had gotten in a fight with the nun and ended up sideswiping the infant Jesus of Prague statue that stood not far from the church parking lot. Sitta remembered ending up at Caro's that night. Vivi had been upset, but Caro kept the bourbon flowing and fed them big bowls of chili. In front of the fire, as Vivi told the story, she switched from tears to laughter under Caro's accepting gaze. The night ended with the women teaching the kids how to cha-cha with a how-to record on the stereo. Sitta remembered dancing, breathless, in Caro's modern living room with the kidney-shaped coffee table and fireplace shaped like a black funnel.
"Listen up, kids," Vivi said. "I sideswiped the infant Jesus of Prague today, and no one must ever know but us. It's a secret." "One, two, three, cha-cha-cha."
That's not the only secret we kept, Sitta thought. They could bribe us and torture us, and we would not betray your secrets, Mama. There are some things you never show and tell.
Chapter 16. The two clippings from the Thorntown Monitor were stapled together, with numerous arrows and exclamation points marked in the margins. Sitta shook her head in amazement. She would have given anything if Wade and May were still at the cabin with her. It would have been great to share with them the news of her mother's entry into a life of crime. The first clipping read, Thursday, August 4th, 1942, daughters of prominent citizens arrested for disorderly conduct. Vivianne Joan Abbott, age 15, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Taylor C. Abbott, Caroline Eliza Bennett, 16, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Robert L. Bob Bennett, Amy Melissa Whitman, 15, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Newton S. Whitman III, and Denise Rose Kelleher, 15, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Francis P. Kelleher, were arrested last night and taken to city jail for disorderly public conduct, charged with violating Municipal Statute 106, the willful soiling of public property and indecent exposure. The girls gave no explanation for their actions. Sitta had always heard rumors of the Yayas being arrested while they were in high school, but she'd never known the details. Oh, how she'd love to transport herself back a half century and just be a fly on the wall. The second clipping read, Tuesday, August 9th, 1942, Shooting the Breeze, Alice Ann Sibley's social column.
A little bird has it that Mrs. Newton S. Whitman III, the former Genevieve Amy St. Clair, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Etienne St. Clair of Marksville, hosted an impromptu patio party for her daughter Teensy this past Saturday afternoon from 4 to 7 in the evening at the Whitman home on Willow Street. Present were Teensy's close friends, Vivi Abbott, Carol Bennett, and Niecy Kelleher, known locally as the Yayas. The girls have made news of late with a particularly high-spirited escapade, even by Yaya standards. Among those in attendance at the evening fete were Mary Gray Benjamin, Daisy Farrar, and Sally Soniat. Among the high school boys attending were Dickie Wheeler, John Pritchard, and Wyatt Bell, along with Lane Parker of St. Petersburg, Florida. Mr. Parker is in town visiting his aunt and uncle, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Simcoe. Served were cold fresh shrimp, cold corn on the cob, tomatoes with dilled onions, and French bread. Jack Whitman, a Thornton High's prize basketball player, entertained by playing tunes on the violin in the French Louisiana tradition. Mrs. Whitman went on to explain that she was throwing the spur-of-the-moment party to celebrate the installation of a new fountain that she has acquired. The fetching fountain, composed of two lovely mermaids who spurt water, is to be ensconced on her patio next to her prize-winning American Beauty roses. Mr. Whitman was not in attendance, having left on Thursday for his camp at Dauphin Island, Alabama. Wonder why he'd ever want to miss such a soiree. It was too rich. Give me more, give me more, give me more, Sitta thought. It was just killing her not to have the whole story. It made her itch, it made her salivate, and it made her wish, not for the first time, that she was part of a girl gang that got its name in the paper. The night of August 3rd, 1942, not 5 hours after Jack Whitman announced he was joining the Army Air Corps, an embarrassed policeman locked Vivi Abbott and the Yayas into a cell in the Thornton Jail. A month or so earlier, American torpedo bombers had swept down over Midway, only to be killed by flak, their young bodies sacrificed as surely as any kamikaze. Lights were dimmed in cities and towns on both coasts, and many inland cities as well. The Pacific seemed far away from central Louisiana, and nobody knew how to pronounce the funny-sounding names of the islands. But Nazi submarines had landed spies on the Florida shore, and although nobody in Washington would admit it, folks in Thornton heard endless stories about the U-boats cruising the Gulf of Mexico. Vivi dreamed of Roosevelt and Rommel and Robert Taylor. On the tennis court, she lobbed bombs across the net to kill Hitler. When she lay in bed at night, after long walks with Jack, her panties moist with arousal, she prayed to the Queen of Peace for all the scared boys in faraway foxholes and on trains crisscrossing the country. She ate little butter, less beef, no bacon,
and when she stepped out, she painted bottled stockings on her legs. She gave blood every Friday. Saturdays, she collected newspapers, and on Wednesdays, scrap metal. Daily, she listened to the news. While the war reports were bleak, the fashion magazines reported that the new uniforms of the Women's Army Corps would add to the prestige of the foundation industry because girdles and brassieres were included in the ensemble. The Catholic Commonweal opposed the recruiting of women. One article Buggy made Vivi read claimed that removing ladies from the heart and home would turn them into pagan female goddesses of lustful sterility. Vivi believed in war bonds and victory gardens. She believed that Nazis and Japs were evil. She believed in democracy at all costs. But what she wanted was tenderness and passion, so she did not believe Jack Whitman should go to war. The August night was hot and humid. It was almost 8 o'clock in the evening, and the temperature had not begun to drop. The moon was almost full, and everywhere there was the smell of grass and river water and high summer in the deep south. In the South Pacific, Marines were preparing to land on Guadalcanal. In Europe, bombers were getting ready for the first all-American air raid. In Thornton, Louisiana, Vivi and Jack were sitting in Jack's 1940 blue-green Buick at LeMoyne's Hamburger Drive-In. Vivi was leaning against the inside of the passenger door with her feet in Jack's lap, holding a Dr. Pepper bottle in her shaking hand. After he announced he had enlisted, the first thing she said was, "Why are you leaving me?"
"It's my responsibility," he said. "Besides, I want to fly."
"You're lying," she said. "I've never even heard you talk about flying."
Then she sat up straight and hit him hard with her fist. She sucked in her breath and tried to keep from crying.
"You don't want to be a pilot. You just want to impress your father."
At first, Jack did not speak. When he did, he could not look at her.
"May we?"
Vivi and Jack had known each other since she was 4 and he was 7. She had spent at least 2 nights a week at his family's home for the past 8 years. There was not a lot he could hide from her about his family, even if he'd wanted to. On the other hand, he also knew her well, knew the unseen marks her mother's blaming, jealous silence left on her, especially after her sister Jessie was born. And he knew the not-so-hidden marks her father's belt left on her skin. He looked at her, hoping he could make her understand.
"Got to do one thing right for the old fella, you know?"
Vivi did know, but she didn't like it, had never liked it. She had always disliked Jack's father. He was arrogant. He made fun of Genevieve's accent. He forbade Bayou French to even be spoken in his home. He refused to let Jack be called by his French name, let alone play the Acadian fiddle in his presence. She had not forgotten Mr. Whitman's condescension, although she did not know to call it that at the time, when after their return from Atlanta, he forced the Yayas to spend tortured Saturday afternoons in training with Miss Alma Ansel, whose job it was to mold them into alluring, well-behaved young women.
"There's one thing right you could do, Jack," she spoke in a near whisper. "Stay home and love me."
The back of Jack's neck was magnificent to her. She had lived her life flirting with hundreds of boys and prided herself on having as many dates as she had the stamina for, but the thought of losing Jack made her ache.
"I'm sorry, baby," he said. "It's already done."
Vivi closed her eyes, and when she opened them, she could not regain her equilibrium. The dashboard in front of her seemed to undulate slightly. She could not make the objects around her stop moving. It was as if the sliver of fine wire on which her inner balance rested had just been imperceptibly bent. The sensation was vaguely familiar. She closed her eyes again and shook her head in tight, quick, hard little shakes.
"Vivi,"
Jack said, reaching for her foot, pulling it slowly back into his lap.
"You okay?"
She glanced at him briefly with a look of pure hatred, then turned away. He began to rub her foot with his hand, a slow, stroking motion. Although she turned away, she could see his hands in her mind, the long, tapered fingers, the short, square nails, large, graceful hands that knew how to handle a basketball, a fiddle, and her awakening body with gentleness and easy confidence. "Will you come back?" she asked.
"Are you kidding? You think I could stay away from you? Of course I'll come back."
"Do you swear to me you will come back?"
He reached over to touch her cheek, but she did not respond.
"I promise, Vivi."
She sat soundless for a moment, perfectly still, staring out. When she turned back to him, she was smiling, her mouth open wide.
"I think I could learn to love a man in uniform," she said, and winked, working hard to sound flirtatious.
But there was something in her gaze that was slightly off, as though she had seen something in the brief time she had been turned away from him and could not shake it. Jack bent down and kissed her foot. He kissed her painted toenails. His black hair fell slightly over his eyes as he leaned over her feet, and when he raised his head, his eyes were wet. He turned his body so his legs stretched out on the seat, then pulled her into his lap. They sat like that without talking for a while. The strains of Ginny Sims singing Deep Purple drifted over from someone's car radio. A flatbed cotton truck with a red cab passed by on the street. The aroma of hamburgers and barbecue sauce wafted through the thick, humid air.
"When you come back, it'll all be fabulous again, right?" she asked.
"Ma petite chou, Uncle Sam's the boss for a little while, but when I come home, you write the ticket.
I might be a newspaper woman by then, Jack."
"We could live in New York. How about that?"
"I like that," she said. "Or maybe Paris, after the war is over. Or I might be a tennis star, live in Rio de Janeiro.
There'll be pictures of you in all the papers.
Or I might be in college studying I don't know what.
You could go to Newcomb, and I'll go to Tulane. Rent an apartment in the French Quarter. We'll head to the bayou on the weekends. How's that sound?"
"I wish I knew how long this war will last."
"When this war is over," Jack said, stroking her face. "Well, would you have me, Vivi?"
This question did not surprise her, and she answered almost casually, sounding utterly sure of herself.
"You are the only man in the world I would ever want to be married to," she said. "If I can't marry you, then I'm going to marry the Yah-Yahs."
Jack laughed. He looked into her eyes.
"You could do anything, Vivi Abbott," Jack said. "You could be anything. Anything you want."
"Will we have kids?" she asked. "Loud, good-looking ones?"
"You want them, you got them. You don't, we won't. Like Maman says, nowhere in the Bible does it say every Catholic woman has to have a ripopay."
"What's ripopay mean?"
"Gang of obnoxious children," Jack explained.
Vivi laughed.
"I can have as many as I want, right?" Vivi said. "Or none at all."
"Roger will go," Jack said.
"Maybe a dozen."
"Okay, cheaper by the dozen."
"We'll put them all in pirogues and row up and down the bayous, teach them the fiddle and squeeze box.
My mom will spoil them rotten. We could name one for her."
"Oh, hell, let's name two for her. Teensy and I will be real sisters. We'll have a 3-story house and raise collies, okay? Tennis court. Can we have a tennis court?"
Jack stopped Vivi with a kiss.
"My father," Jack thought, "my father will see what kind of man I am, and he will be very, very proud."
"Because," Teensy said, as she poured rum into a tumbler filled with Coca-Cola and handed it to Vivi, "Jack made me swear not to say a word until he told you himself."
The Yah-Yahs, having returned from their respective dates later that night, sat in their panties, smoking cigarettes and talking on the upstairs sleeping porch of the Whitman home.
There's not a goddamn breeze in the state of Louisiana, Caro said, slumped down into the cushions of a rattan chair, her feet propped on the screen, smoking a cigarette.
He only told Mama and Father and me this morning, Teensy continued. Father came home from the bank this afternoon with a bottle of French champagne to celebrate. Can you imagine French champagne?
Leave it to your father to lay his hands on something like that in the middle of the war, Caro said.
I've never seen Father make over Jack like this before. Not when he was elected class president or captain of the basketball team. Papa said he's going to organize a black tie scrap metal drive in honor of Jack signing up, and we're all supposed to put on the dog.
Well, what did Genevieve say? Vivi asked. She sat next to Nisi on the glider, holding her drink against her left temple.
Mama asked if it was too late to change his mind, Teensy said. Father called her unpatriotic. My God, woman, Papa said. This is France. This is the free world we're talking about. You know how he gets. Made a little speech and gave a toast to Jack. Mama wouldn't even touch the champagne, and y'all know how she adores it. She went upstairs, and after a few minutes, Jack went up to see about her.
Fanning herself with one of Genevieve's fans made of vetiver root, Teensy lay across one of the beds.
It's really rather momentous, y'all, she said. The first one of our crowd to join up.
The other three didn't respond.
Well, isn't it? Teensy repeated. Isn't it marvelous?
Oh, it's marvelous. It's thrilling. It's Jimmy Stewart, Vivi said. Only it means Jack has to go far away for a long time. It means he will sit suspended in the air miles above the earth in a small metal cigar while Germans try to kill him.
Goodness, Nisi said. I never thought of it like that.
Of course you didn't, pal, Caro said. Miss Apple Blossom time.
Jack went out to Spring Creek after he dropped me off, Vivi said.
Father gave him a whole book of gas stamps, Teensy said. Our mother of pearl, Caro said. Is your father the president of the black market? The guy can get his hands on anything.
I don't know, Teensy said. I never ask.
Bunch of the guys are going with him, Vivi continued, taking a drag off her lucky. A stag party to celebrate, I guess. They're spending the night out at the creek.
Well, they should have taken us with them, Teensy said. It's always cool at Spring Creek. I'm about to die from all this humidity. I wish somebody...